Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
If I mention the topic of homeschooling to you, what image would you immediately conjure up? For those outside the homeschooling movement, you would probably think of an isolated family in the countryside with a stay-at-home mom educating a couple kids in the garage every day. Now, that picture may hold true for a few families, but over the past several decades, homeschooling has become increasingly sophisticated, with parents pooling their educational and financial resources to create cooperatives that can serve the schooling needs of several hundred children at a time. And these co-ops range from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade. Indeed, your own adorable, fuzzy little host here has had the privilege of speaking several times to a homeschool co-op that is based at a local Seattle megachurch and which serves roughly 600 students across all grade levels. And not surprisingly, the growing popularity of homeschooling has ruffled the political feathers of many within the public school establishment, and many parents have discovered numerous legal barriers to their efforts to educate their children in a manner they best see fit. To talk about the various political and legal issues involving homeschooling, with specific attention to religiously based homeschooling, we are a podcast on religion after all, I'm pleased to be joined today by Mike Donnelly, adjunct professor of government at Patrick Henry College and a full-time staff attorney with the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Mike, welcome to Research on Religion.
It's great to be with you today.
Let's go ahead and start with laying the historical groundwork of the homeschooling movement to really give some context to our discussion here. And now I know we probably could take the homeschooling movement back several centuries because during medieval times, if your children were educated at all and you weren't part of the elite class, you were probably homeschooling. But really, what I want to do is focus here on the 20th century and talk about when homeschooling has taken off in the past, say 4 or 5 decades or so. What can you tell us about the homeschooling movement recently?
Sure. Well, in the 50s, Rush Dooney wrote about home education and Christian education in the context of what he saw to be a crisis coming in the public schools for Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the 60s, you had, of course, the 60s were an interesting decade in our history. A fellow by the name of John Holt, who was kind of a secular fellow, who wrote about different ways of educating and a sort of a reaction to the institutional method of learning. You also had a fellow by the name of Dr. Ray Moore, who was a Christian, who was calling on Christians to think about educating their children in different ways. So that's in the 60s. You had these two folks who were kind of looking at schools and saying, hey, this isn't really working. For John Holt, it was kind of, this is a bad way for, people to learn. People need to be taught individually.
And yeah, that's kind of interesting because again, I think a lot of my colleagues and other folks around the country associate homeschooling largely with a religious movement. But Holt is a secular guy. I mean, what was his big beef with the school system at the time? Why did he think?
Well, he said, hey, we can make cars in a mass production facility, but we can't really make people in a mass production facility.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, I think that kind of cuts to it. I mean, I'm not an expert on Holt's, philosophy, but that's what I understand it to be. At the end of the day, it was a rejection to the institutionalized approach to learning where you treat every kid like a square peg and you stick them in a square hole. And he said, we don't need to do that. And that's not free thinking. The government's in charge of the schools and we don't like the government. And so we don't want our kids to be learning what the government says. And at the same time, this is in the 60s when you had a lot of things going on with the Supreme Court. In fact, when you look back historically at the number of cases, federal cases that were going through the federal courts, the 60s, there were like 1,200 cases. Now, a lot of these were civil rights cases, but there were other cases too, freedom of speech cases, T-shirts cases, and in cases, prayer cases, getting prayer out of schools, taking Bible reading out of schools, things like that. So during the 60s, public schools in America were going through an upheaval. The country was going through an upheaval, but the schools were going through an upheaval, and Christians were looking at public schools much more skeptically going into the 70s. Now, when you know, and that's really when a lot of people point to the start of the Christian school movement, 60s and 70s. In the 70s, you had the nascent homeschool movement. In the late 70s, Dr. Moore and other people began taking homeschooling on the road and really encouraging people to look at it. And you had just a sort of a sort of spontaneous critical mass of people and resources, and homeschooling just started taking off. Now, this is when homeschooling really started to become identified as Christian, because you had lots of Christians who were not satisfied with the public schools because they were getting worse and worse in the 70s, who had been looking at the Christian schools and weren't necessarily so satisfied, and they're expensive.
Right.
And they said, you know what, we can do this, and we want more for our family, and we want to give our children a true biblical education. And so just thousands and tens of thousands of Christians began starting homeschooling in the 80s, and the movement has grown to 2 million homeschooled children in the country now. There are about 2 million children who are homeschooled.
That's quite a huge number here. I'm kind of thinking back to the 1970s, 60s and 70s too. You have more women entering the workforce. It would seem to me that traditional religious couples would probably be more likely to have stay-at-home moms that would be able to engage in this kind of thing. So I could probably understand, even though there's a secular component to homeschooling education, that there's a comparative advantage in some of the religious families that where the mom does stay home.
Well, someone has to stay home. And, someone has to be the teacher. And frankly, God designed women much better suited to do that than men, I would argue.
No, having tried to teach my son lessons, he's like, no, I'm going over to mom, please. So, yeah, I can kind of understand how that is going on. Yeah.
I think that's probably true. I mean, Christian women were much more willing to be countercultural in that respect and stay home. And they were staying home, a lot of them were staying home, even though their kids were in public or Christian schools. But for the homeschooling mom, the Christian who wants to homeschool, mom's there, and this is a great way for her to really engage with her kids. So, you saw just phenomenal growth of homeschooling between 1980 and now 2010, where we have 2 million homeschooled students, about 3-4% of the entire school-age population, just under half of what you have. I think people estimate private school populations about 10, 11, 12%. So it's definitely it's a significant force.
And I've noticed as well, too, that there's been an industry that's grown up around there servicing the needs of homeschoolers with textbooks, curriculum, other types of material as well. So you see these around not only on the Internet, but there's several stores around us that you could go in, brick-and-mortar store, and you look at homeschooling material.
Well, sure. And when you look at and there's a lot of different ways to look at the homeschool movement and population and sort of figure out that it's primarily Christian. And you look at all the business associated with it, the vast majority of it is catering to a Christian worldview. And when you look at other research that's been done, for example, the Department of Education, every 4 years they do an issue brief. The National Center for Education Statistics does an issue brief on home education. And in the latest one that was published December 2008, they pegged the number at about 1.5, 1.7 million homeschoolers at that time. They asked some questions about why parents homeschool. And it was interesting. They break down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the 7 major reasons that parents homeschool. And number 2 is a desire to provide religious or moral instruction. In 2003, 72% of the respondents said that was, a reason for homeschooling. That number jumped from 72 to 83 in the year 2007. So you had a real growth in that being a reason why people are homeschooling. Now, they haven't qualitatively said that this is a rank order of reasons, but it's a reason. The number one reason, of course, was a concern about the school environment.
Right.
And that went from 85% in 2003 to 88% in 2007. And, of course, those things go together. Parents who are concerned about the school environment are concerned about the values that are going on, that are being taught in that environment. Of course, they're also concerned about the safety.
Yeah, I was wondering if they parsed that out at all, if it's safety curriculum.
No, they didn't parse out, you know, safety versus moral versus, you know, peer pressure, that kind of thing. They didn't parse it out. They just said a concern about the school environment. But you know that a big part of that is just the negative anti-Christian environment that exists in the public schools.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the other reasons given there, the top seven reasons?
Sure. The other reasons are dissatisfaction with academic instruction at other schools, not just public schools, but that included other schools. A desire to take a non-traditional approach to child's education. This was 32% in 2007. Other reasons was, non-traditional actually was 65% in 2007. That was a big one. The other reasons was 32%. A child having special needs. That actually went down from 29 to 21, but still a significant reason. And the child having a physical or mental problem, which is kind of a subset of having special needs, went from 16 to 11. So between those two, having a special needs child, you're looking at about 35% said that was a reason why they were homeschooling.
Let's talk about some of the demographics of this, because, again, I've talked to colleagues about homeschooling, and we will occasionally have homeschoolers run through the University of Washington, and they're surprised by the quality of student that we get from the homeschooling movement. It actually surprises my colleagues, because I think the image of the homeschoolers, you know, some knuckle-dragging Neanderthal wants to remove themselves from society and go into some fundamentalist cult or something like that. What do homeschoolers look like demographically?
Homeschooling families?
Yeah.
Homeschooling families tend to be married families, stable families, upper income, more educated than the average person. I mean, it's a pretty high-level demographic, the average. Now, that's not everyone, but that's the average.
Right.
You know, it's a very desirable demographic. Now, of course, you know, this is for marketers anyway.
Yeah.
This is a family that's still surviving basically on one income.
Mm-hmm.
So mom's home and dad's working in most cases, and you know, and there's no split to it in terms of urban or rural. You know, homeschooling is. It cuts across the spectrum.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to ask, too. I mean, one of the interesting things I've been finding out at the homeschool co-op that I've spoken at was that it was largely a suburban area, and one would think that, well, you're very happy with the suburban schools and such. But, again, when you think about that demographic that you just talked about, higher income on average, two-parent families, higher education levels on average, you are going to be talking around suburban areas here.
Well, yes. I mean, it's very suburban. I mean, I would say probably there are fewer homeschoolers in the cities than there are in the suburbs. But you've got a lot of homeschoolers in rural areas, too. So there may be a difference in terms of concentration. But, you know, it does. You can find homeschoolers in every single geographic regional area, no matter how you want to slice it up. There's probably a homeschooling family. I mean, there's 3 to 4% of the homeschool population. So wherever you've got 100 students, 3 or 4 of them are going to be homeschooled.
So what about family size, too? I would imagine that, well, actually, I don't know. I mean, small families seem easy to educate one kid, but if you got 5 or 6, well, that can be pretty tough. So,
well, yeah, homeschooling families tend to have more children on average. Probably, you know, I don't know what the current average is for the average American. It's like 1.9 or something
right,
like that.
Right around 2, yeah.
Yeah, for homeschoolers, it's probably closer to 2.5, 3.1.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to have more children. I mean, personally, I have 7 children.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of the circles that I travel in, you know, I'm kind of average.
Yeah, okay. And you homeschool?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
okay.
I homeschool, actually. In fact, my son is with me in the office today.
Oh, very cool.
He's got his books, and he's, you know, doing his work as we're talking.
Oh, excellent.
One of the benefits of home education.
and what grade do your kids range from?
They're age 13 down to 2 months old.
Okay.
My son, who's 13, is, I would call him a freshman sophomore.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little bit ahead in terms of years. And, you know, I'm not the kind of person to just sort of say, yeah, just take your time and just do whatever. I mean, I want him to master the material, but my hope for them is that they're going to finish their secondary education before they're 16 and start moving into college material around 15, 16, so they can kind of, I mean, you know, this whole business of staying in school until you're 18 or 19 years old, I mean, at the high school level, that just seems a tremendous waste of time and
yeah.
Resources.
Especially if the children can and master it at that level, which is brings up another interesting point too. When I mention homeschooling to people, where most people think, oh, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and for the most part, parents, you know, having gone through this with my own son, you can handle the curriculum at that point in time. But when you start getting into the middle school years, junior high, high school type of areas, you start getting into the math that, well, some of us adults have forgotten over time. Does there tend to be a drop off with homeschoolers? Is there a movement toward homeschooling in the first 4 or 5 years of education, then send the kids off to high school? Or how's that working out? What's the spread across the grade levels?
Well, anecdotally, there does seem to be a slight drop-off at the high school level. I think you do see that some homeschooling parents feel a little intimidated about teaching physics or biology or, algebra or calculus or what have you. Although I think that may be changing. Here at HSLDA, we encourage people to homeschool through high school. We have a lot of resources, and one of our resources is two ladies who homeschool their children all the way through high school, and there are homeschool through high school coordinators. And, what we found is there are just a tremendous amount of resources for parents who want to homeschool their children through high school. You know, here's the thing about kids. Kids are natural learners, whether they're 5 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now maybe when they're 15, they're becoming slightly less natural learners, but...
yeah.
And maybe, they're becoming more self-motivated or have to be directed by mom or dad or the teachers, as it were. But, they really are natural learners, and... You know, if you find out how they're uniquely gifted and talented, where God is calling them in their lives, and you guide them into that area, and provide them with resources and the materials, they are going to learn, and they are going to master the material and master the skills. And you see this with homeschoolers. That's why you have so many homeschoolers who win spelling bees, win geography bees, win, NASA essay writing awards, science awards. I mean, there was an article recently of a young man who built a particle accelerator in his basement with another homeschooling young lady as part of a National Science Foundation thing. They have the time to do that because they're not in an institutional school that isn't going to let them do that, first of all, and doesn't allow that kind of creativity and exploration, and doesn't have the resources or the time. You go to school at 8:30, you get home at 3, you got 2 hours of homework, maybe you do some activities. It's very structured and regimented. Homeschooling is a lot more flexible and really allows kids to go deep in an area where they're interested.
You mentioned stuff about spelling bees and building particle accelerators in your basement and stuff. Let's talk briefly about the results. I mean, what homeschooling in terms of, in comparison to private schooling and in terms of public education, where are homeschooling students tending to fall out here?
Well, there's been a lot of research done on this, and it starts back in 1997. Where a research study was done that found that homeschoolers on average outperformed their public school peers by 30 to 37 points on all subjects on standardized tests. Okay, just this past year, another study was done with about 12 or 13,000 homeschooled students all across the country looking at standardized test scores. And again, they actually went up a couple of points in some areas. So they tend to score quite high in standardized tests. Measures of academic achievement.
In terms of the academic achievement after homeschooling, the next step is college.
Uh-huh.
How likely are colleges to accept homeschoolers? What's your perspective on that?
Well, it wasn't always so easy. Homeschoolers had to create their own paths in a lot of ways, and we still do encounter some resistance from some schools. Most of the top universities, they get it. We have resources on our website that talk about how homeschoolers are doing in college, and the averages, they tend to do somewhat better in terms of GPA. A study was just done by a professor at St. Thomas, I think it's St. Thomas University in Minnesota, where he looked at the freshman class and the senior class and found that homeschoolers attrite at a lower rate. They have higher GPAs in the first year and the fourth year. Colleges, universities, really try to recruit homeschoolers from what we've seen. Brown University, the dean of admissions there, said that they love having homeschooled students because homeschooled students are ready to learn, they're aggressive, and they engage.
Right.
Because they've had to learn. They've been ready to go to that level of learning for years, because that's how they're taught from the beginning. You know, again, the people maybe think of homeschooling as mom sits down, they have a little one-room schoolhouse, and some people do it kind of like that. But when you've got 3 or 4 or 5 children at different age levels, you have to have a different model of pedagogy. And you've got to really rely on the student to really do more of the work themselves, as opposed to spoon-feeding it. It's more of a guiding, mentoring, encouraging sort of approach.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the economics of this, too, and I'm glad you brought that up, of how you do this with children who are much older, you know, 12, 13, 14, where the material is getting a little bit more complex. As you mentioned, many of these folks are self-motivated. You put the material before them and encourage them to devour it, and they often do. But there's been also a growing movement to form cooperatives, which seem to take comparative advantage. And again, I hearken back to the homeschool co-op that I taught at when I was first invited to come and give a lecture there. I thought I would walk in, there'd be, you know, 20 people or so, but it really looked like a parallel high school. Yeah. And not even a high school. It ran from K through 12. I think most of the students there tended to be toward the upper grade levels. And I started asking questions about this. You know, how many students do you have? And they said, oh, we're upwards of 550, 600 students that meet once a week at this place. And what the parents do is they all chip in, I don't know, $50 or $70. They then go out to the local community and they find somebody who's interested in a specific topic. You might find somebody at an aerospace company who knows algebra or calculus very well, and they hire this person to teach that kind of subject. How has the homeschooling cooperative movement grown over the years?
Oh, well, it has grown. It has grown over the years. It's become a popular way for parents who are concerned about a couple of things to be able to connect. You know, it is a connecting point. You know, homeschoolers tend to be slightly less connected in some regards, although I should probably be careful saying that. I mean, they're really not less connected, but, you know, they're home, and they're focusing on the home and the family.
Yeah.
And so, you know, mom's home all day, and we're dealing with the kids. And so a homeschool co-op, on one level, also provides mom with an opportunity to connect with other moms, you know, socially. And most of the co-ops, you know, get together, and the moms will contribute their expertise, or they'll go out, as you said, and find someone in the community to come in and teach a class. And they can be quite elaborate. I mean, the one you're talking about, that's pretty elaborate. They can range in size from 10 to, I guess, 5 or 600. They definitely are very popular. They're all over the place. And they cater to those parents who want to do that. And you can take one class. In some of the co-ops, kids can take most of their academic subjects, which kind of, you know, leads you to the question, is that really homeschooling, or what is that?
Yeah.
But it's a form of education.
Right.
And it's, it's parent-directed education, certainly. And, for some families, it works really well, and they really enjoy it. Some people do it, some don't.
Yeah. The social aspect, I think, is really important, because I got to talk to a lot of the parents who were there. And, you know, this, as you mentioned, this was a chance for them to connect. I think one of the other stereotypes of homeschoolers is that they tend to be socially isolated and unable to manage regular social skills, where in, you know, the local public school, you learn all your social skills, apparently, interacting with other people over Justin Bieber videos or something. Before we get into some of the problems that they face, there's one other demographic question I have, and this might transition us to the issue of where there are some substantial regulatory barriers and where there's not. But that's how this movement has spread over the country. Is it evenly spread across all 50 states, or are there some pockets of the country where homeschooling tends to predominate?
You know, it does not appear that way. It is pretty well spread across the country based on population.
Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem to be any regional concentration at all. It's really wherever there are people, you're going to find 3 or 4% of them are going to be homeschooling parents.
Mm-hmm.
Generally.
So I can imagine that is going to raise some challenges legally in different parts of the country. I'm imagine some states are more open and welcoming to homeschoolers, and other places are not. So let's turn to some of those challenges facing homeschoolers.
Before we do that, could we talk about the socialization issue a little bit?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that.
Back to that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because that's often a criticism that is leveled at homeschooling. You know, they say, well, what about socialization? And I'm looking at a volume 16 of the Homeschool Researcher, a 2004 report, where Dr. David Francis and Dr. Timothy Zeit, Dr. Keith, is a professor of educational psychology at UT, University of Texas in Austin, and Dr. Francis is a school psychologist in New York. And they did a study on the social skills of homeschooled students compared to conventionally schooled children. And this was based on a standardized test of socialization measures. So it wasn't a sort of a soft approach. It was looking at these hard skills of social competencies. And when they looked at the public school students versus the homeschooled students, they found that the homeschooled students actually performed as well, if not higher, in some areas, on these sort of standardized measures of social competencies. And so the truth is, the research shows that, you know, homeschoolers are as good at socializing as anybody else. And, you know, when someone raises that question, what about socialization, I have to question the premise of that question. Because the premise of that question assumes, it seems to me, that a purpose of education is socialization. And I'm not so sure that I agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, to me, you know, if I were sending my children to a public school, it would not be for socialization. It would be for them to learn so they could go on in life and learn a skill and be productive, self-sufficient, literate adults. Not so they could go on into some clique and become part of a social group. Yeah. But I mean, it does appear, though, that today's public schools are very much social environments. I mean, they certainly have become that. And as people, I guess you would expect that when you get groups of people together, you're going to have social groups. And you're going to get some kind of socialization. The question is it good socialization or not?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention that, because in my neck of the woods out here, I live in rural King County in the state of Washington, so we get a mix of a lot of people who are in public schools, private schools, and who do homeschooling. One of the big concerns of parents who have toyed with the idea of homeschooling has been that socialization issue. And then I oftentimes think about some of the stories that I hear coming out from the, you know, local high school and junior high, and I'm like, I don't know if that's that great of a socialization process. And you know, whether, you know, you let your 12-year-old and 13-year-old kid figure out their own social groups, or they're probably still at an age they still need some guidance there.
Well, they do, and you know, and you know, schooling and education is not a morally neutral endeavor. You know, there is some moral content in it, and as parents, it's our responsibility to oversee the spiritual development of our children. And when parents make the decision to enroll their child in a public school environment, they're making a spiritual decision. You know, some people will, you know, within the Christian community, you have divides over this issue of, you know, homeschooling sometimes. And, you know, the reality is, the research is pretty clear on what happens to Christian kids who go through the public school system.
And what's the bottom line on that?
Well, the 80% of them turn away from their faith. When I heard those statistics that came from George Barna, he did this research.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard that, my kids were still young. I already knew that they weren't going to go to a public school. But when I heard that, it just hit me so hard that, you know, education is not spiritually neutral, morally neutral. You know, it is how children learn who they are and who they're going to be. And it is so important for parents, Christian parents particularly, to make sure that they are, even if their kids are in public schools, that they are actively involved in that spiritual development process.
Right. Yeah, that's an absolutely fascinating statistic. I'm going to have to check out George Barna's work on this kind of thing. And it does bring up the issue of the whole notion of spirituality or the content of education and the church-state divide in this regard. And I guess I'm going to use that here to transition to some of the issues that have been brought up.
Sure.
With homeschoolers, specifically religious homeschoolers, because I can imagine that public school systems have not been all that pleased by seeing now 2-4% of the population moving away from the public school into homeschooling. So what are some of the general problems that homeschoolers, and specifically religious homeschoolers, have faced legally?
Well, legally, you know, the homeschooling movement has had to fight a battle. I mean, in the late 70s, only 5 states explicitly recognized homeschooling as an exception to the compulsory attendance laws. Okay, you know, most states, I mean, all states, all 50 states in 1980 had compulsory attendance laws saying you have to send your child to a public or private school unless you have a certain exception. And only 5 states at that time recognized exceptions for parents who did it at home. Between 80 and 2000, in about 2000, it went from 5 to 50. And our association, HSLDA, was at the forefront of that battle, working in courts and in legislatures. A lot of it was in the legislature, where parents would go, homeschool groups would go to the legislature and say, hey, we want an exception, make a homeschool law for us. And some states would make laws that were restrictive, like Massachusetts. Well, Massachusetts actually was a court case, but in some cases they would make a restrictive law, New York, for example, which you have to send in quarterly reports and you have to do a lot. Pennsylvania, also very restrictive law, with a lot of oversight by the local school district. Other states are less so. And also in courts, we've had a lot of battles in courts in a number of states. In Massachusetts, as I was mentioning, there was a court case in 1985 which sort of established the criteria for home education, parents who wanted to homeschool their children. And it, you know, in that case, the court interpreted the existing law to allow for the superintendent of the school district to approve a parent homeschooling. Now, there's only 2 states that are still approval states in America. Massachusetts is one of them.
Mm-hmm. What's the other one?
Rhode Island.
Okay.
And now they're approval in name only, really, because I don't know of, I mean, I know of attempts by some superintendents in some of the school districts to deny permission, but generally they don't, because it's just too much of a headache for them to deny permission. So, and what ends up happening is the family just sends in the information, and the superintendent may go back and forth a little bit on the plan, but they know the parents have a right to do it, and they're gonna sign off on it. So today in America, homeschooling is very free. Although there are attempts still to try to impose restrictions, more restrictions on homeschoolers. Now, here at HSLDA, we've done some research and we've looked at research that shows that there's really no correlation between the kind of regulations that a state has and the sort of the academic achievement of the homeschoolers. Pennsylvania homeschoolers, Massachusetts homeschoolers score above average, 25, 35, 40 points on average. On these standardized academic tests when compared to public schools. Same is true in states where you don't have to do anything in terms of notifying the authorities, like Texas or Illinois. And Illinois is interesting because Illinois is in the news recently. A senator there put forth some legislation that would have required homeschooling parents to register. Today in Illinois, you don't have to do anything. You just, you know, the state leaves you alone. You're homeschooling your kid. You have certain obligations. And, you know, as long as you're doing that, good. But the senator said, no, we need to know where all these kids are. We got to have people register. We got to have contact with them. And there was a big, big deal. You had 4,000 homeschoolers coming out to the Capitol and saying, hey, leave us alone. It was a big deal. So, you know, when you look across the country, you know, the environment today is free. It's pretty free. It's legal. Each state is different. And there are attempts in some states to impose more restrictions. And in other states, they've loosened things up. In New Hampshire, this legislative year, there's an attempt to go from a notification, which is basically when you tell the superintendent or the state that you're going to homeschool, and an assessment where you have to do some kind of test or portfolio or teacher review every year.
Right.
They're trying to go from that to just having one-time notification with no assessment.
Yeah, it's the live free or die state. So.
Well, it is the live free or die state. You'd think they would have something a little freer than that.
Yeah.
So there's movement across the country. There's always something going on. And it really depends on each state. You have to look at each one individually. But that's kind of a, you know, a general snapshot of what's going on legally across the country.
Now, you mentioned these quarterly reports. And again, they're not standard across all states, but places like Pennsylvania might require them. What does that quarterly report entail? And has that been put in place as a significant barrier by the legislature because they're responding to teachers' unions or public school districts that say, hey, let's make homeschooling a little bit more costly or difficult so fewer people peel off into that endeavor?
I don't think it's motivated by that. I think it's more motivated by the sense that we're the professionals. And we are responsible for children's education in the state, and therefore we need to be in some position of oversight or control. Although, you know, there is probably some you know, financial element running through this, they don't tend to make arguments like that. The arguments tend to be, you know, hey, we need to know what these people are doing so we can make sure they're doing a good job. So that's what, you know, motivated most of these laws that require these kinds of quarterly reports or annual progress reports. We want to, you know, have our check-in and make sure these parents who, you know, who think they can teach their kids, and now after 25 years we've shown that we really can, you know, we want to make sure that they are doing it.
How onerous are those reports? When, is it 500 pages of paperwork, or is it just a single page?
No, yeah, they're not that. They're generally not that onerous, and only a few states have any kind of quarterly report or, you know, anything more than once a year. And they're not that onerous. You know, it's, you're supposed to send in the grades, basically.
Okay.
You send in the grades, or you send in a progress report about what you're working on, and that sort of thing. So it's not overly onerous.
Well, what are some of the other restrictions that you've run across? Now, the HSLDA, and we'll talk about them in a little minute on how they formed and what services they perform. But what kind of restrictions have you seen, and what kind of cases in specific have you had to legislate, or not legislate, but what kind of cases have you had to prosecute here in defense of homeschoolers?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Me personally?
Mm-hmm.
I've been involved in a number of cases. I am licensed in a number of states, and I litigate in those states, Massachusetts and West Virginia in particular. And, you know, this past year we had a pretty egregious example of overreaching on the part of the state in West Virginia, where a family had not complied 100% with the law. They hadn't filed all the paperwork that they were supposed to file. And what had happened was social workers had been called by a irate family member. And they came in.
Was this somebody directly in the family, or was it a cousin or something?
No, it was a fairly close family person.
Okay.
A mother-in-law or something like that. And this actually happens frequently. I mean, it's really sad, but I get a lot of calls from homeschooling parents who need some advice about how to handle some kind of investigation by the authorities because they're dealing with a member of their family who don't agree with their choice to homeschool their children.
Right.
But in this particular case, some of the allegations were not related to education, but some of them were. And the ones that were not related to education, like, you know, they didn't have heat in the house, for example, or they didn't have food, were simply false. Now, the educational allegations were that the kids weren't in school. And that's true, they weren't. They were being homeschooled. This family hadn't filed all the paperwork, however. But long story short, the social workers, in this case, actually took the children out of the home on this basis for 5 weeks because they hadn't filed all their paperwork, okay? And so we got involved. Now, they were not members at the time. Had they been members, I'm almost certain that this never would have happened because when we get involved early, we can prevent these kinds of really bad outcomes. But what happened was the social worker made a decision, and she abused her position, we believe, and the judge did a very bad job in allowing the social worker to do this. And what you had was you had a family that was torn apart for 5 weeks, and these poor kids are still, this was over a year ago,
right.
These poor kids are still recovering from this separation from their parents,
yeah.
Even a year after. Now, for the parents to get their kids back, they had to agree to keep them in public school till the end of the year.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, so they took custody, they put the kids in school. The kids were actually doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
They did some testing. They put them in basically the same grades that they were in, and they were doing fine. There was no question that the kids were being educated here, okay? But the state just decided they were going to come in and they were going to have their way, and they ran roughshod over this family. In the end, we got it resolved. It was dismissed. The family was not actually found guilty of any kind of neglect at all. But they had to endure this state supervision and being in this kind of a relationship with the state for a long time. So that's a very egregious case. But those are the kinds of cases that we can get involved with on individuals when they're having disputes with authorities, whether it's a social worker or truancy officer. Truancy is another thing. You know, sometimes one other case I dealt with in Massachusetts. This is a very interesting case. This mother had one child, a boy who had who was diagnosed with Asperger's on the autism spectrum, and she wanted to homeschool him because he was having a hard time at school.
Mm-hmm.
The school principal said, there's no way I'm going to let you homeschool this boy. You don't have the ability to do that. You're not qualified. Who do you think you are? You know, and I'm only roughly paraphrasing, okay, this woman's attitude towards this mother. They got the social workers involved. Now, they didn't end up taking the boy away. But so I got involved. I had to travel up to Massachusetts on a number of occasions to go to court to fight for this family's right to be able to homeschool their boy, because in Massachusetts it's an approval law. And so the superintendent can withhold approval. And in this case, this was the principal who had the problem, and eventually the superintendent got tuned into what was going on and said, we're not going to spend all this money on legal fees. We're going to let this family homeschool. You know, give us a plan that we can approve and go off and prosper and do well. And so we were able to do that. But it was a 9-month-long process of having guardians ad litem and court-appointed investigators and social workers involved in this family. That is a very intrusive and destructive, I would argue, process for a family, very harmful to a family, and should not be done lightly. But in these cases, you see, when you have recalcitrant, uninformed, or simply authoritative or authoritarian people, principals, social workers, what have you, who say they're going to have their way, they're going to make decisions for these families. So those are the kinds of cases that we can get involved with. And those are serious cases. It can run the gamut down to just writing a simple letter to someone saying, you know, maybe you misunderstood the law. Here's what the law says, and that can make it go away as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is a individually specific case, but it when you're talking about it, brings up an issue that I hear quite a bit about licensing of teachers and the question of, well, we have trained specialists in our schools, not only that deal with the general education of students, but also students with special needs like Asperger's or something along that line. It sounds as if this principal in Massachusetts was saying, well, you don't have the training or the specific qualifications to handle this kind of situation here. This brings up the issue of licensing. Does that issue come up with parents? I know recently there was a movement in California, and I don't know if this has gone through the legislature or not, but I recall hearing this about a year or two ago, where the California state legislature wanted to license homeschooler teachers, meaning parents.
Well, what happened in California a couple years ago, and this may be what you're referring to, there was a court case that came out of a Los Angeles appeals court that said that only parents who were certified teachers could homeschool their kids.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so that was a court case in California. That was an appeals court in California interpreting California law, and they basically were wrong. They just interpreted the law incorrectly. And we got involved with a number of other organizations. It was a big deal because it had some very serious ramifications. But in the end, we won, and so the way people in California homeschool is they file a private school affidavit, and there are very few requirements that you have to have in order to be a private school in California.
In California?
Yes.
That's California on the West Coast.
California.
And no, I wouldn't put California and few regulations together, but okay.
No, literally you wouldn't, I know. But California actually has one of the best sort of situations for homeschoolers in the country. So it's great. I mean, New Jersey, too. You kind of think the same thing about New Jersey and Connecticut, but they actually have legal regimes that work really well for homeschoolers.
Well, why do you think that is?
In New Jersey and Connecticut?
Yeah, and California. Again, I would be thinking that the states that are most amenable and open to homeschooling might be your North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana type of states.
Well, actually, North Dakota, South Dakota are challenging somewhat.
Mm.
Anyway, you got to look at, you know, each state has its own interesting history.
Yeah.
And so you'd have to look at each one. But and each one really does have its own story. In New Jersey, the law says, you know, children have to be instructed in school or receive equivalent instruction somewhere else. And it just says that. So that right there says, you know, as long as your child is getting equivalent instruction, you can just do whatever you want. So it becomes up to the state to enforce it. And so if a parent is found homeschooling and there's evidence that they're neglecting the education of their child, then the state has the authority to, you know, kind of prosecute the family, although they tend not to. But that's what you're at risk of if you're in one of those states where you don't have any kind of notice requirement. You're at risk of, you know, coming to the attention of a social worker or a truancy officer or some other state official and possibly getting involved in, you know, some kind of proceeding regarding education.
That's kind of interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about North Dakota or South Dakota. I'm a little bit surprised by perhaps the higher legal barriers than, say, a New Jersey or California.
Well, you know, I want to be careful because I don't want to oversimplify, but in states like Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, you had populations there, and I want to be real careful here because I'm not an expert on these things, but I wonder if this is true. You had populations that went out there that, you know, were German and Swedish and Norwegian, and you know, and you have certainly diverse populations out there now, but these were how these populations grew. And so they were more, maybe I'm thinking, or maybe a little more tolerant, or maybe a little bit more supportive of overarching state control over things than maybe in other places where you might have more rebellious people, you know, like the pioneers in California who, you know, are less willing to put up with that kind of stuff. But so, and you also have to look at the power of the teachers' associations and the education associations. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a difficult thing to sort of generalize and say, well, in South Dakota it was because of this.
Right, right.
And South Dakota is not my state. I don't know the history of it, so I can't really comment on it specifically. But I think it is kind of a combination of those factors, of the culture of the state, of the strength of the teachers' unions and associations, because the NEA has a position that is very anti-homeschooling.
Right.
They say every child should be taught by a certified teacher. And so then that's not a parent. Most parents are not certified teachers, and therefore they're against homeschooling. And the NEA has some very powerful, you know, political lobbying force in a lot of states. And I think in those Midwestern states, they're pretty powerful.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to see if there are any patterns. And some of the cases that you mentioned here are on a case-by-case basis. Have you seen any general patterns that have occurred in terms of barriers put up by something like teachers' unions or other types of legislatures, state legislatures perhaps dominated by anti-homeschooling groups or people with that ideological slant? Have you seen any general patterns across the country with respect to that?
Generally, teachers and professional education associations very much are opposed to the concept of home education. But the reality is home education is here to stay. Home educators are very effective lobbying organizations and grassroots activists. You know, if you want to get 4, 5, 10,000 people out to a capital, mm-hmm. you know, in a large state, mess around with a homeschooling law.
Yeah.
You know, like in Illinois this past 2 weeks ago. Okay, I mean, you've got stuff going on in Wisconsin, you know, about public unions. Homeschoolers are about as, you know, quick to descend upon the Capitol when somebody's threatening their freedom.
Yeah, that's really interesting, too, because you would, again, assume that the homeschooling population is one that is very dispersed and would be very difficult to achieve any type of collective action amongst them, but they seem to be networked incredibly well in terms of that.
Very highly networked because they know that, you know, we are few, and so there's strength when we come together, and so you see there are state organizations for homeschooling in every state. You've got HSLDA, we're a national association, and we have over 80,000 member families, and we stay very closely connected with the state organization so that we can work together if there's ever a threat to homeschooling either at the federal level or at the state level. We look at thousands of bills every year that are introduced to determine, you know, whether or not there might be a negative impact on homeschoolers. We inform our members, and we encourage them to take action to protect their freedom.
Has there been any pattern to the how states and perhaps the teachers' unions have adopted to homeschooling? I'm starting to think about here in my state of Washington, where we have state funding to school districts is doled out on a per-student basis, and any homeschooler that or any family that chooses to homeschool, that's a couple kids that are not going to be in the school district, and that can potentially affect funding. And, you know, in some cases where you start to get to 300 or 400 or 600 students peeling off of the homeschool district, that gets close to having to close a elementary school, which is always a political hot potato here. And so in the state of Washington, I've noticed that there have been efforts to incorporate homeschoolers into the public school curriculum at certain points, maybe physical education or some kind of language specialty, teaching French or something like that. And if they can engage some homeschoolers in some of these activities then it counts partially toward funding or they get the full credit for the student. Has there been movements to by school districts, teachers' unions, and state legislatures to really adapt and change or adapt to this changing environment?
You do see those kinds of things across the country in various places. Sometimes it's at the county level where the county will want to, you know, try to bring more homeschoolers into their part-time programs so they can claim them as a half-time student.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely see that. You know, at the state level, you know, it's interesting. We've got an issue in Colorado where there's some legislators trying to pass a law that would grant tax credits to homeschoolers and parents who's put their kids in private school. And it's getting a lot of resistance from the teachers' unions. I mean, they all always oppose school choice, seems like. And, you know, but if that law were to pass, it would save the state of Colorado tens of millions of dollars at the state level because the state funds, you know, X thousands of dollars per student. And for each student that comes out of the public school to a private program, the state doesn't have to cover that cost anymore.
Right.
And so at the state level, it can save tens of millions of dollars. But you're right. At the district level, these schools are now losing their students, and so they're not going to be getting as much resources. And who likes that, right? What superintendent wants to give up resources? So you definitely see that. But I would have to say that we don't see a trend in any one direction. But those are definitely issues that you do see in most states at some level or another.
Now, we've been talking mostly about the United States here, and you mentioned you cover a number of territories or a number of states, such as West Virginia and Massachusetts. But from reading your profile, you also have been engaged in these issues at the international level, specifically Germany. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yes, that's very interesting. I've been working on trying to promote freedom for homeschoolers in Germany for about four years now. And it's a pretty grim situation in Germany, and Sweden is fast coming up to tie Germany in its oppression of parents who want to homeschool their children.
Well, I can imagine just Europe in general, maybe with the exception of a few pockets, that homeschooling is not very popular there.
Well, it's certainly not as popular there as it is here, but most states do allow for it in some way, shape, or form. In fact, in Ireland, it's even in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to look at Europe sort of like you look at America and the states and say, yeah, there are some tendencies, but you have to each look at each country. But you're right. I mean, it is definitely seen less favorably generally there than it is here.
So tell us about this German case.
Yeah, the interesting case in Germany that we were involved with was the Romaika family. They are a homeschooling family. They're religious Christians, and they wanted to homeschool. Now, in Germany, if you try to homeschool, you're gonna quickly come to the attention of the authorities because in Germany, every town knows exactly where you live and how many children you have because you have to register.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, they keep tabs on everything. And if your kid doesn't show up in school, they're going to know it. And so this family actually went and told the school, we're not going to be sending our kids to school anymore. We're going to homeschool. And the school said, you can't do that. That's not allowed. And they said, well, we're going to do it anyway. And it's not. Technically, it's not allowed. There's no law that allows for homeschooling in Germany, in any of the states in Germany. And it's a uniform policy, and there have been cases that have gone to the German Constitutional Court, like their version of the Supreme Court, that have said that it's okay for the state to not allow homeschooling. Why? Because it's in the state's interest to what the Supreme Court in Germany said to suppress parallel societies. They actually wanted to call homeschooling a parallel society.
Wow,
which is absurd.
So that's the language that's used? That's not some mistranslation from very difficult German words?
No, the German word is Parallelgesellschaft,
uh-huh.
Okay, which is parallel society. Gesellschaft means society. Parallel society. It's a good translation. That's what the German court said. Yeah, I mean, they have it's a very different culture over there. They look at religion very differently than we do over here.
Yeah.
At any rate, this family said, you know, we're doing this. And the authority said, no, you're not. And they battled over the course of a year or two, and it involved police going to the home and actually taking the kids forcibly to school. Then they were fining the family hundreds and thousands of dollars. And finally, I heard about this family, and I said, hey, if you come to the United States, you might be able to qualify for political asylum, and if you did that, we'll help you.
Mm.
And they did.
And how's that turned out?
Well, in 2008, they arrived.
Right.
And in 2010, they were granted political asylum by an immigration judge in Memphis, Tennessee, because they are Christians who want to homeschool for religious reasons, and also because they are part of a social group known as homeschoolers, and the German government, this judge found, is targeting homeschoolers, and under asylum law, that qualifies you to get asylum. And so they won asylum in the United States for homeschooling.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. I would not
it
have
sure
expected
is.
That outcome. You know, people think seeking asylum from Germany here in the beginning of the 21st century, that
yep.
any judge would have accepted that. But that's pretty amazing. And that, you know, very well could set some precedent for other homeschoolers throughout Europe as well.
Well, unfortunately, the government, the Obama administration, has appealed the decision to the Board of Immigration Appeals. And we're still waiting. It's been a year now that we won, and it's been 7 months since we appealed, or since the government appealed, since all the appeals paperwork was in.
Yeah.
And so we're waiting. We're expecting it's going to be another while because it's kind of a high-level sensitive case, and they tend to sit on those things, apparently. But we're hopeful that we'll retain our victory for this family, and if we do, then it will set precedent. And if we don't win, we'll be going to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals to argue on their behalf, and I think we have a very strong case.
That's interesting. It's got to be rough on the family having to pick up from your place of birth or the area that you've grown up with and then come here. And then, you know, even though the court cases, you know, might be handled financially by other organizations such as yours, you know, pro bono work or what have you, just the time invested in this must be pretty harrowing for the family.
It's pretty significant sort of upheaval, you're right. But they're doing great. Homeschooling was very important.
Mm-hmm.
And they were willing to, you know, kind of become modern-day pilgrims and leave their home, leave their families, leave everything they knew behind and come to a place where they could have freedom. That's really what it was about. It was about having freedom, religious freedom, really. And they have really adapted well. I stay in touch with them. I see them pretty frequently. And they love living here. They love the freedom they have here. They love the people here. America, we have a lot of great things about America. As many bad things as we can look at, and there are a lot of bad things going on in our country, we have to remember that as a country, we are the best country in the world for freedom.
Uh-huh.
Even today, even for religious freedom, we are a beacon of hope to the rest of the world, and we shouldn't ever forget that.
Well, it's great to see that your organization is really taking on this case and you know, spreading the news or the word about the different challenges that homeschoolers face, not only here in the United States but abroad. Tell us in the few minutes that we have remaining here a little bit about your organization, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. When was this created, and how big of an organization are you, and what role do you have?
Well, HSLDA was founded in 1983, so we're about 28 years old.
Mm-hmm. And that's fairly early in the homeschooling timeline. As you mentioned, it gets started in the 50s and 60s, but really only starts picking up in the
right.
1980s.
Yes, that's right. And actually, we were founded by a guy from Washington.
Oh, Washington State.
Michael Ferris.
Oh.
Washington is from Washington State. And worked there for a number of years, and then moved out here and with a couple of other fellows, founded this organization in 1983. And we have over 80,000 member families, which is over 160,000 individual members. And our role is to advance homeschooling and to support and defend the right of parents to direct the education of their children as they choose, in the area of homeschooling. And so we have a staff of about 20 legal staff here, attorneys and legal assistants. We have a number of support staff. We're about 70 to 100, people, depending on full-time, part-time people,
mm-hmm.
Supporting our members and the homeschooling movement. We do a lot of things. We have specialists who can consult with our members on homeschooling issues that they're having, whether it's high school issues or elementary issues or homeschooling a special needs child.
Mm-hmm.
The bulk of the work we do, of course, is legal work when our families encounter resistance, like some of the cases I've talked with you about. But it can also be situations like you know, the federal government is not recognizing that a child is in school and therefore doesn't qualify for Social Security income anymore. Mm-hmm. And so we litigate cases. We write lots of letters to superintendents and school committees and school boards and principals to represent our members when they're being asked to do something that is not allowed by law. Homeschoolers are very zealous to protect their freedom.
Right, I can imagine.
And so we work to make sure that the authorities are educated and understand what they are allowed to ask for and what they're not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes they're trying to get things that they're not entitled to, and so we will stand in the gap and defend our families.
And now
are very involved in making sure that the legal landscape remains free and, if possible, if even freer. And so we're involved in analyzing legislation, proposing legislation to legislators all across the country. And at the federal level, we have a federal lobbying arm, and we stay connected to make sure that the federal government leaves homeschoolers alone. So, you know, we're looking out for the homeschool movement 360 degrees.
And from what you told me about your membership and from what we said earlier about the size of the homeschooling population in the United States, it looks like you cover about 40 to 50% of homeschoolers out there are affiliated in some form with your organization?
I wish that were true.
Is it lower?
We're probably somewhat less than that.
Okay.
Because if you figure there's about 700,000, 750,000 homeschooling families, we've got maybe 1 in 10.
Oh, there you go, 10%.
One in seven families.
Okay.
We wish it was, one in two. It would give us a lot more, resources to be able to do, the things we're doing and more things to support home education. But we're very grateful for the members that we do have, and we'll help people regardless of whether we're a member or not, because, we're a nonprofit organization, and our cause is homeschooling, home education, and we want to help encourage people to do that. And I hope that, if there's some people listening today who aren't doing that, that they'll, visit our website at hslda.org and maybe think about how homeschooling could fit into their family.
Yeah, we'll definitely put a link to that up on our website so people can check you out and see what's up there. The other last thing I want to mention here, you're an adjunct professor at Patrick Henry College. And I, in searching around colleges around the United States, I stumbled onto Patrick Henry, and I noticed that that college is actually geared toward homeschoolers. Give us a little history about Patrick Henry.
Sure. Well, Patrick Henry College was actually started by HSLDA, and Mike Ferris was the guy who started HSLDA, and he started Patrick Henry College. And it was really started as a place for homeschoolers, a high-end, very competitive liberal arts college where homeschoolers could come, and it's a Christian college,
mm-hmm.
and come, and the vision is to create leaders who are going to change the culture,
mm-hmm.
for better.
And what's your enrollment out there?
Enrollment is about 300.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'll tell you, here's a little statistic. For a school that's been around 10 years with an enrollment of 300, the school has won 5 of the last 7 National Moot Court Championships.
Wow.
Yeah. So the quality of the students that come here is very high. They're great, wonderful Christian students. I love to interact with them, and I see them all the time because our offices are on the campus. So it's a wonderful place for homeschooled students to come. It's not just homeschool students. We have, I think 20% of the enrollment is public or private school as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not all homeschool, but it is, I think, 80% homeschool. And it's very exciting, a great faculty here and some very exciting things that they're looking at expanding and doing in the future. And for a 10-year-old college, God has certainly had his hand on Patrick Henry College.
Yeah, certainly a lot of interesting changes have been going on there at Patrick Henry, and then which the HSLDA and the homeschool movement in general. And we'll be sure to stay in touch with you on that, but we are out of time here on our show. And so I encourage folks to visit our website to check out the links to HSLDA, Patrick Henry College, and a few other things, and join the conversation. Mike, it was great having you on Research on Religion today.
Tony, thank you so much for having me on. God bless you and all you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.